Je vais vous demander de prendre place, s'il vous plaît. Nos pensées, bien entendu, ce soir vont aux victimes des attentats de Belgique. C'est la deuxième fois que nous avons à faire une telle annonce dans ce cycle de conférences. La première fois, c'était pour les attentats du Bataclan. Donc, une nouvelle fois, nous avons à conjuguer le sort et à envoyer nos prières aux victimes de ces atroces attentats. Mon nom est Pierre-Emmanuel Moïse. Bienvenue à cette dernière de la série Une pensée d'avance, Think Ahead. Je vous souhaite donc la bienvenue. Think Ahead conferences are focused this year on surviving technology, new technologies including drones, automatic weapon systems and cyber warfare have revolutionized military capabilities on the battlefield. In tonight's lecture, we will explore how international law of armed conflicts responds to the legal and ethical challenges posed by such technologies. I now have the pleasure of introducing our four guest speakers. Our first speaker, Professor Frédéric Maigret, is Associate Professor of Law and William Dawson Scholar at McGill. Professor Maigret's interests lie in the theoretical dimensions of international criminal justice, international human rights law, and international humanitarian law, as well as general international law. He holds a PhD from the Graduate Institute of International Studies from the University of Geneva and of the University Panthéon-Sorbonne-Paris 1. Professor Maigret is the author of Le Tribunal Pénal International pour le Rwanda, published in 2002, and is currently co-editing a handbook on international criminal law, Oxford University Press, forthcoming to 2015. Is it published, released? It's not published. Okay. Professor Maigret's talk tonight is entitled Cyber Warfare. Our second speaker is Dr. Cassandra Steer, who is Erin Arsenault Fellow at the McGill Institute of Air and Space Law. Her main research interest lies in the application of the law of armed conflict to military uses of outer space. Prior to coming to McGill, she was a junior professor at the University of Amsterdam. She holds a PhD in international criminal law from the University of Amsterdam and has interned at the International Criminal Court. Her talk tonight is entitled Star Laws, Why the Law of Armed Conflict Matters in Outer Space. Our third speaker, Dr. Tanya Krupi, is a postdoctoral fellow at McGill University and is a recipient of funding from the Social Sciences and Humanities Research Council of Canada. She holds a PhD in international humanitarian law from the University of Essex in the UK. Her current research focuses on determining under what circumstances corporation managers, corporate shareholders, computer programmers, and military commanders may be held accountable when a lethal autonomous robot malfunctions and, as a result, triggers an international crime. Her talk tonight is entitled Holding Accountable Programmers and Corporate Managers, The Paradoxes Presented by Lethal Autonomous Robots for International Law. Our fourth speakers, Maître Eric Ward, graduated from the McGill Faculty of Law in 2002 and clerked for the Honorable Frank Iacobucci in the Supreme Court of Canada. Since then, Eric has held various positions in the Government of Canada, including as a Director of Machinery of Government and Director of Legal Operations at the Private Counsel Office. Currently, Eric is Senior Counsel with the Center for Information and Privacy Law at the Department of Justice Canada. Tonight, in a talk entitled Killer Robots and Other Targets of the Legal Imagination, he will speak to us about the various impulses of the legal imagination towards regulating technology and provide historical examples of notable successes and failures. Please join me in welcoming our speakers. Before we begin, a few housekeeping remarks. Number one on my list, please turn off your cell phone, anything that rings or buzzes. For those who, of you attending the first time, for the first time, please note that we are live streaming the lecture in an overflow room on the other side. During the Q&A period, students will make microphones available to you in the moot court. We have to insist that you use the microphone so that participants in the overflow rooms can hear your questions. Third, there will be one break this evening, if you behave, around 7:30. During the break, those who need them will find washrooms in the basement. It's on my notes. You can also get some snacks from a table manned by law students in the atrium. You know the way. Tonight, the food is brought to you by the Rad Law Solidarity Across Borders SABHNC project. This McGill Law Faculty student initiated and coordinated project provides an opportunity for students to gain experience in immigration law by working directly with community organizations and members. The project connects law students to refugee migrant families and individuals who are in need of urgent support to complete their humanitarian and compassionate claims. In groups of two and with lawyer supervision, students work alongside applicants throughout the entire application process. Please give generously. In the next few days, you will receive an email with your attestation certificate. If you have not yet done so, please make sure that you check at the table in the atrium during the break so that we know that you are here and we can send you the attestation. As mentioned in previous occasions, I would like to bring to your attention a change in the way you will report your continuing legal education or hours to the Barreau. Starting this year, McGill is a dispensateur reconnu by the Quebec Bar. It means that all CLE activities offered by McGill now have the same number. If you attend more than one CLE activity at McGill during the current period of reference, and we hope you will, you do not need to add a new activity in your online record. You simply edit the original McGill Faculty of Law entry by adding the total number of hours. More information is provided in the attestation that you will receive. Je cède maintenant la parole à mon collègue et ami Frédéric Maigret.
Bonsoir à tous. C'est un grand plaisir de pouvoir participer à cette série à nouveau. I have a great memory from last time I participated. One of the great things is I don't think I ever have lectures that are that well attended. So here's to captive audiences. And the other good thing is most of you are probably not on Facebook, at least you're not. I'm not facing laptops, which is kind of very comforting and is a welcome change. So I'm going to be speaking on cyber warfare tonight, and I realize this may not be an issue that you're thinking about on a daily basis, and it could get quite technical, and it might happen. It's something we might experience one day here, but I'm not really here to prepare you to that or to go really deep into the technicalities of what it might mean for an international lawyer or an international humanitarian lawyer, someone interested in the regulation of warfare. Rather, I just want to use cyber warfare as a theme in the current global conversation on these issues to illustrate a number of recurrent and pernicious problems we have when dealing with all issues of cyber, it could be cyber crime or issues of civil law in the virtual world. And I think there's a common thread that runs through a lot of these issues once seen through the cyber lens and the tendency that the World Wide Web and sort of the virtuality of big data has of making what once seemed solid melt into air, to use a famous quote from the Communist Manifesto, the sense that notions that we rely on as lawyers that are, I think, firmly embedded in territory, in the sort of concreteness of physicality, of geography, that these notions are no longer quite as solid when we're talking about things happening on the internet. Certainly as an international criminal lawyer, I've dealt with issues of the site of a crime, where is a crime committed, that is committed on the internet, for example. And some of the issues are quite difficult to address in a cogent way. Though sometimes that can also be overdone. So I think there's, you know, a new cottage industry of commentary on everything cyber, and sometimes it boils down to, you know, it's not that different from what would happen in the real world. Theft and cyber theft have sort of similar elements, and so there, you know, isn't really a need to reinvent the wheel. It's a slightly, you know, different variation on something that we're quite familiar with. So I think cyber warfare is what, you know, the status of a cyber warfare debate in international law is quite interesting. That, you know, people have picked up on this quite a long time before it became a real and worrying issue. And this is what international humanitarian lawyers in particular try to do. So they try to anticipate on these developments. Two decades ago, people were talking about a protocol to ban laser blinding weapons. I mean, there was no such thing. The weapon actually, like, it was just rumors that some states might have been developing them, but they didn't exist yet, but it seemed worrying as a trend. And so a protocol was adopted just in case. And so you're trying to nip in the bud some of these threats before they materialize fully. So, you know, people have been talking about these issues for maybe a decade, and I credit some of them for their foresight. But in the meantime, this kind of science fiction has started to become reality. So there's, it's not as if every conflict out there has a significant element of cyber warfare, but there's certainly now a few well-known examples of warfare having been deployed in cyberspace. Okay. Perhaps the incident that most brought this to the fore was the Georgia-Russia war in 2008, where particularly, I think, Russian groups were extremely active in engaging in defacement operations and denial of service operations directed at a selection of Georgian ministries, the parliament, down to the president's own website. So it was Georgian internet users in 2008, you know, as the war started, would have opened, that would have reached the president's website, only to find a picture of Adolf Hitler kind of superimposed on the president's picture. And, you know, these things don't in and of themselves, I mean, seem necessarily particularly worrying. They're not in themselves constitutive of war, but some of the operations are more concerning, and they may involve, for example, via the use of viruses, efforts to impede the functioning of major infrastructure, facilities, including, why not, nuclear plants, etc. So, given our society's reliance on a kind of digital infrastructure, the vulnerabilities are there. And there's certainly a fear in military circles, for example, that the amount of damage that could be caused by a carefully sort of calibrated virus could in some ways be far greater than, you know, traditional conventional means of armed conflict, bombings, etc. So that fear is there, and I think it's why, you know, beyond the sort of denial and service and defacement issues, it's a concern. Perhaps the clearest example we had, and it operates somewhere in a gray zone between warfare and espionage, is the quite successful unleashing of a virus known as Stuxnet on Iranian nuclear facilities a few years ago. Origin as yet unknown or not extremely clearly identified, which is part of a problem, among other things. But suddenly in Natanz, in Bouchevert, the centrifugeuse started spinning like crazy, and the Iranian engineers couldn't figure out what it was. And you can imagine, I mean, the net result was that a lot of them were disabled, but could have been worse. You know, what if this had triggered some kind of, you know, dispersion of uranium or something worse? What are the implications? I mean, is this allowed in the first place? In what zone of international law does it operate? What about consequences on civilians? Now, obviously, all of this, and I'll leave aside, but you know, perhaps with a thought to what happened this morning, but obviously, among the great users of cyber warfare or kind of users of cyber violence, a range of non-state actors, including ISIS, who, you know, use the internet for purposes that are related to war, including propaganda, the planning of certain operations, and you know, that may at some point acquire the ability to infiltrate networks and cause damage in that way. So all of this occurs against the background of international law, traditionally, of course, having been very preoccupied with the issue of violence in international relations for over a century, and at least two ways that I'll sort of introduce briefly, and I'll get back to them. But one of them is what is known, and you know, apologies for my Latin, known as the jus ad bellum. You'd think that, you know, after all this time, international humanitarian lawyers would have found a better term than the Latin, but it's still the shorthand. So the jus ad bellum is the conditions under which use of force is allowed in international law. Right? And under what conditions can a state attack, well, probably not attack, but defend itself against another state? So it's, in a sense, a big issue. When is use of force legal in international law? I mean, the jus in bello is a quite different subset of issues. It's the conditions in which warfare can be waged legally, assuming that it is already being waged for whatever good or bad reason. How does one limit the incidence of warfare, particularly on non-combatants? Prisoners of war, surrendered combatants, but also, obviously, civilians. So I think my argument tonight, and I'll try to be quite brief, is that cyber warfare is really raising issues and questions for both of these areas of the law, and probably in the process forcing us to rethink some of their implications. Now, so in the process, I think there's a bit of an examen conscience to be done for international law, and you know, you find lawyers sort of reacting slowly to these cyber issues in essentially the same ways in various fields. And one of the questions I think for international lawyers is, well, are we too wedded to a sort of kinetic, physical model of warfare, right? I mean, this is the blueprint, in a sense, for war goes back to, you know, the 19th century, if not earlier. And of course, for a long time, what was imagined was you know, armies fighting battles on a battlefield, and we know that throughout the 20th century we moved quite significantly away from that model, but perhaps at no time more so than in the current era, where it's become possible to imagine armed conflicts of a sort that would occur entirely between perhaps computer programmers operating from a distance, you know, via networks. And of course, you know, the reality of that situation, I think, has been reinforced by the whole, in the current era, by the use of drone warfare, right, which is often warfare that is heavily mediated by the use of computers and sort of virtual reality and all kinds of intermediaries or screens that separate the dispenser of violence from the recipient of violence. So that virtualization of warfare is there, you know, already and has been for quite some time, probably as early as, you know, aerial strategic bombardment, right? There's already an element of virtuality there. At the same time, I think international humanitarian laws and international laws in general have to sort of, and lawyers for that matter, have to resist the notion that, you know, simply because this is a new phenomenon, all the old rules can be discarded and we need sort of, you know, radically invent everything. I think one of the merits of international law is that it's a sort of fairly flexible, adaptable system of rules that has endured the age. And I think the onus is on those who think that, you know, really new rules ought to be developed to show why, and one always has to be a bit wary of their motivations and what they try to do in the process. Now, let me just, before I get to the jus ad bellum and jus in bello issue, I just want to flag three phenomena that make this issue particularly vexing for the law and that are helpful to contextualize what cyber warfare is about. So first, deterritorialization of the laws of war and of the law in general. So the sense that the matrix of the law is no longer territory that we had come to think of as so helpful, for example, to understand sovereignty, jurisdiction, the state, what's domestic, what's international, you know, borders, the difference between a citizen and a foreigner and an immigrant and an asylum seeker, etc. All of that is, you know, being put in flux by cyber activities and the tendency of a lot of activities to be, if not impossible to localize, at least harder. The second phenomenon is the democratization of war. And, you know, democratization is normally a good thing, but I'm not sure democratization of war is. And this is obviously a broader phenomenon than just cyber warfare. We have more and more violent entrepreneurs out there. But in a sense, you could say that the internet and computers have lowered the entry barrier to warfare, right? In the old days, to become a participant in armed conflict, you essentially needed to be a state, because only states had the infrastructure and the ability to develop, you know, the powerful weapons that characterize armies. Nowadays, you could be a group of two or three hackers operating from a basement and quite possibly develop something that is immensely destructive, right? And so that's what I mean by sort of radical lowering of the entry costs in that game of domestic and international violence, which is obviously worrying. Which doesn't mean that states don't remain in some ways the leading actors, and states have huge cyber warfare capabilities, but they're not the only ones to do so. And interestingly, quite often rely on non-state actors. So you see, for all kinds of reasons, but partly because the expertise is out there with sort of young kids in, you know, Russia, who may not be a part of the Russian government, but may be quite happy to lend their help in 2008 to penetrate these Georgian websites and critical systems to disrupt them. And obviously, as we'll see, these has all kind of implications for both the jus ad bellum and the jus in bello, because one of the key questions you want to answer as an international lawyer is who did it, the sort of a who did it question. And it makes a big difference that it's a non-state actor or a state. You want to be very careful about attributing to a state something that, you know, a non-state actor did on its territory that maybe it didn't have any control over. And obviously the consequences could be quite dire, since we're, you know, talking about armed responses as one possible consequence. And finally, kind of third phenomenon, which struck me as quite central to all of it, is the problem of stealth and invisibility. Now, obviously, all armies historically have wanted to be stealthy and invisible, and it's part of your sort of your defense. But on the other hand, you know, they're generally not shy about claiming attacks that they've launched, and, you know, they're camouflaging themselves, but it's quite clear that they did it. The armed conflicts tend to be quite open. Whereas I think one of the sort of characteristics of cyber warfare, not all the time, but quite often, is that states use it in a way that is closer to sort of espionage or counter-espionage efforts in a way that is secret. So you know, an attack may occur, and at least you'll see the concrete results of the attack, but it may be very difficult to attribute it to anyone, and that sort of paralyzes the functioning, the operation of the law, because the consequences would vary hugely depending on who had actually done it. And, you know, in that process, it's worth noting that there's a number of non-state actors that have a clear interest in things being attributed to certain states, so they'll, you know, capture the servers of a state and then launch an attack against another state from that, in the process exposing the state whose facilities they're using to certain forms of retaliation for nothing that it had, for something that it had no part on. So real evidentiary problem there. Now, very briefly, let me look at some of the key jus ad bellum issues first. So how does cyber warfare and the possibility of cyber attacks change the conditions in which states can respond to armed threats by other actors? So the first question is, when is cyber warfare a use of force? As you may know, in international law, and it sometimes I think comes as a surprise to my students, but the use of force is actually prohibited. Has been for quite some time, and your responsibility as a state is liable to be engaged for having used force against another state. The problem is, you know, traditionally we knew what a use of force was. You kind of send in the troops, the paratroopers, whatever, you bomb another state, that's a use of force. Is a cyber attack a use of force? Well, it's not a use of force in any conventional kinetic sense, right? Nothing may be destroyed, and it doesn't, ça ressemble à une action armée, but it has the sort of it may have similarities, but it isn't quite the same thing. So the International Court of Justice has told us, you know, there are ways you can use force against the state without actually deploying troops in that state. For example, merely financing a sort of guerrilla group might, or at least controlling them, might suffice. But the criteria are not especially clear. I think one of the easy cases is, of course, if there is death, injury, or significant damage. But you know, we don't really know that for sure because there isn't a great deal of state practice. We don't have any cases to go on. It may be that destruction of data will be, you know, seen as the equivalent of a destruction of physical destruction, but it's not clear when and how that might happen. So the next question is assuming that, so simply because there's a use of force doesn't allow you as a state to respond. It merely engages the responsibility of the other state to be able to fight back and to exercise your right of self-defense under the UN Charter. You need to be a little more specific than that and be able to claim and prove that there was an armed attack. So that raises the state, you know, the threshold even higher, right? So an armed attack is unleashing a sort of denial of service kind of cyber operation, is that an armed attack for the purposes of Article 51 of the UN Charter? Obviously, the consequences are great, because if it is an armed attack, regardless of the fact that it's virtual and cyber, you might be allowed as a state to retaliate not just in kind, but possibly with kinetic force. Here there's a lot of hesitation amongst international lawyers. Obviously, if there's significant damage or injury, it doesn't really matter that it was virtual and cyber as opposed to physical force. The question is whether a very significant disruption of services in a state might be treated as the functional equivalent of an armed attack. So an example would be, what if a state were to launch, very hypothetically, a virus on another state, on its kind of stock exchange or its central bank, that, you know, obviously wasn't armed in and of itself, it's just a virus, it doesn't make any sense today, but it's armed, doesn't provoke death or injury or physical destruction to facilities, but provokes a massive meltdown of the economy of a target state. So is that an armed attack? Does it reach the threshold of gravity that would allow that state to claim its right to self-defense under the UN Charter? You know, so far, a lot of the international humanitarian lawyers have been resistant to that notion. The typical argument, the response is, you know, they would probably concede that the destruction through a cyber operation of a few factories, as in the physical destruction, would constitute an armed attack, right? I mean, whether you're bombing them from the air or destroying them by unleashing some, you know, sort of complex reaction as a result of a failure of critical systems, it kind of boils down to the same thing. So why do we value physical destruction so much in relation to what may be, in, you know, in some ways more significant social effects and a more significant attack on the state's sovereignty, its very ability to, you know, do what it's meant to do? Now, there's a lot of problems there, and it is particularly disconcerting that we don't have a bright line yet. We may, as often with international law, we may have to await precedent and sort of history in the making. Maybe just point a few things that I think cyber warfare increases the risk of. First, I think it will probably increase the risk of preventive self-defense, which is a sort of perennially bothering issue for international lawyers. Can you attack another state, you know, just before it attacks you? So, if, for example, you know, sort of massing the tanks at your border and you know they're, you know, about to attack you. Traditionally, international lawyers would have said, well, they actually have to have attacked you because who knows, maybe they're just, it's just a maneuver, maybe their intentions are not bad or they'll decide at the last minute to pull back. But a lot of more realist-oriented international lawyers are saying, well, you don't have to wait to be hit. You can sort of, you know, hit if you have intelligence that they're about to attack you. That's contested, but I think in a cyber context, if you know that, you know, a massive attack is a cyber operation is going to be deployed against your state imminently, I don't think, given the devastating potential of such an attack, how quickly it is to launch it. I mean, imagine that maybe, you know, it's a bit like the equivalent of pressing the nuclear button, right? It's just, you press a button, the attack is launched, well, it's been prepared long in advance, etc. But, you know, surely states will claim the right to strike the target, whether it's a state or a non-state actor, before. And then I think the other problem that we're going to face is the risk the non-state actors resorting to cyber warfare will sort of drag states into war with them by making it unclear who originated the attack, and, you know, creating a kind of casus belli that states will, you know, will probably only be too willing to fall for. And so I think that, you know, the phenomenon we've been seeing for quite a while, I mean, the disruptive potential of non-state actors and violent movements for international law is already well known, but if they're doing their misdeeds in a sense in a way that's shredded in secrecy, that leads to all kinds of possible attributions in situations where states are relatively panicked, and maybe rightly so, about the possible consequences of cyber warfare, I think there's a grave danger there. Now, let me turn now to the jus in bello issue, so issues of maximizing the protection, the humanitarian protection of persons hors de combat. And French expression, I'm happy to report, is still used. It's one of the rare cases, personnes hors de combat, by international law. So there's all kinds of questions. One of them is, for the laws of war to apply, as opposed to ordinary domestic law, you know, international human rights law, there has to be an armed conflict. A huge amount hinges on whether an armed conflict is actually occurring. Right? Now, it's difficult enough to define what an armed conflict is in some cases, but if it's kinetic and, you know, sort of forces of two states are fighting, or a state is fighting a rebel group, it's pretty clear once it's a little, it goes beyond, certainly, especially in the non-international context, beyond a few skirmishes and sort of violent protests. You know, think of Syria as a point where the Free Syrian Army is fighting and it controls a certain amount of territory and it's able to engage in sustained operations. We have an armed conflict, right? But the question, I think, may be much harder when it comes to cyber warfare. So there's two scenarios. Either there's a real kinetic conflict actually occurring, we've already determined that, and there's a cyber warfare element piggybacking on it, then of course, you know, l'accessoire suit le principal, you know, it's part of warfare, and all actors will be bound by the rules of international humanitarian law. The question is, can you have an entirely cyber-based war that creates its own armed conflict, right, without the helpful supporting evidence of a kinetic physical conflict. I don't think I'm going to fully address the question here, but you'll have to look at things. Well, you know, the level of severity, but it doesn't take much if it's between two states. Obviously, if it's just a disruption of services that is not creating loss of life or injury, it might just kind of fall under the espionage category. There's a certain understanding that states do bad things to each other, but there's a difference between spying and destroying, right? So I think where I would draw the line is Stuxnet, the virus, is there to destroy Iranian nuclear facilities. Is not just there to sort of gather data about them. And so, you know, that element of destruction, especially between states, if only we knew who'd done it, would get us a lot closer to an international armed conflict. The second thing, so assuming there is an armed conflict, I think the cyber nature of warfare complicates the application of a number of the key rules of international humanitarian law. So let me give you one or two examples, and I'll finish with that. First example is the principle of distinction. So one of the key rules in international humanitarian law is you need to distinguish between the civilian population and between military objectives. You target military objectives, you don't target civilians. Now, this is hard enough to respect in ordinary circumstances. Is a bridge civilian or military? Well, the military might use it to cross the river in a way that's extremely strategic, but maybe civilians also, you know, commute on it. Is the electric grid a civilian or military facility or military objective? The issue arose in 1999 in relation to the Kosovo campaign. So when it comes to cyber warfare, I think, you know, there's generally an understanding that, for example, psychological operations, you know, trying to convey certain messages to the enemy population via cyber means, that, you know, would not in itself be illegal, but there may well be cases where you are actually targeting the civilian population through cyber warfare in ways that contravene international humanitarian law. So international law is a very divided. Some of them stick to the idea that there has to be an act of violence, right? And so by which they typically mean physical violence, and they're a bit wary of the fact that a lot of cyber attacks are not really inherently violent. They're disruptive, but disruptive is not the same thing as violent. Another school focuses on the consequences. So they say, well, it doesn't really make sense to think of cyber attacks as being violent or not in the absolute, because a cyber attack is just, you know, a programmer sort of, you know, inputting, you know, some virus or something somewhere. That's not violent. What matters are the consequences, there you would have to look at whether the civilian population is being affected by cyber warfare. And so there are cases, for example, in Georgia, no one was hurt, right? I mean, defacement, denial of service, unpleasant, maybe the internet crawled to a halt and, you know, it took longer to reach your favorite, you know, Facebook page or whatever, but that is not really the same thing as being targeted by violent acts of warfare as a civilian. Second problem is one of the key questions in contemporary warfare is who is a participant in it, right? And if you're a participant in war, that means you can be targeted back. Right? Now, it used to be relatively easy when those participating helpfully, you know, donned sort of red and, you know, bright uniforms to send the strong signals that, yes, I'm with the military, I can kill you, but you can kill me, and, you know, don't kill the person who's not wearing this uniform. And the one thing you can do under the laws of war is kill enemy combatants. But you can't do all the rest, which is, you know, kill people who are not enemy combatants. And here I think there's all kinds of problems. Of course, if the cyber warriors are part of the enemy army, it's very easy. You know, they're just sergeants and colonels, part of a cyber warfare unit. There isn't a problem. You know, you can target them in their offices in downtown, you know, the capital of a state. They are legitimate targets, even if they're far from a battlefield. The more problematic case is where individuals who are not strictly affiliated with the armed forces are engaging in acts of cyber warfare. Is that sufficient to make them into targets, right? Can you bomb directly the hacker operating from his basement who's not wearing a military uniform, who may be working at the tolerance of the state but isn't directly taking his orders from a military structure? And, you know, international humanitarian laws have a few rules. They say, well, if a group is an armed group, well, what's an armed group? Can you be armed with a computer? If they're organized, but what if they're virtually organized? So a lot of them, you know, organized in a very decentralized, fluid fashion. Some of them may never have met each other. They're just kind of hackers who met each other in a, you know, in wherever hackers meet each other, I don't know, somewhere on the World Wide Web. So, you know, they're not really organized in the sense of a militia. In a lot of the traditional senses that international humanitarian law has tried to make sense of these issues. If they're not combatants by nature, then they're civilians, right? But the laws of war have long had to deal with the problems of civilians who occasionally participate in warfare, right? The sort of Sunday soldier. So the person who is a civilian, but then upon seeing the enemy army march in, you know, he's sort of galvanized by his patriotism, seizes his gun and starts attacking the enemy troops. So the understanding there is, he's directly participating in hostilities. So for the duration that he is assuming that combat function, he's a legitimate target. So I can assure you that this has led to innumerable headaches for international humanitarian lawyers because, you know, a lot of people are unhappy with the fact that they can, you know, sort of revolving door, they can be combatants one second and civilians claiming civilian immunity the next. But, you know, at least there's this small window of opportunity where you don't have to wait until you're shot at to shoot back. Now, the question is, how does this operate in relation to cyber warfare? The civilian who's, again, in his basement, sort of is preparing a deadly virus that he's about to unleash on the infrastructure of another state or on the state, can you target him? Well, obviously you can probably target him as he's clicking the button that is launching the virus, because then he's directly participating, right? But the time, the window during which he's directly participating is quite small. So one approach would be, well, the minute he starts to, you know, throw a few notes on a sur un comptable planning his malware, then he becomes targetable because these are preparatory acts to an act of warfare. But, you know, the humanitarians will be indignant and say, well, no, he's a civilian, you know, shouldn't be doing this, but he's a civilian, he ought to be respected as such. So very difficult questions, and I'll leave it there. I don't want to take any more time, but just to say that international lawyers have met around these issues. There's a sort of manual that has been, of soft law manual that has been elaborated by a number of sort of officials and international lawyers, trying to anticipate on the moment developments that are not quite there with us, and in the process trying not to sacrifice what I think has made the laws of war one of the few protective devices in armed conflict. Thank you very much.
No, our second speaker for this first half, Dr. Cassandra Steer.
So I should say first up, I have damaged my vocal cords, and usually sometimes at the end of the day my voice gives out as it's about to do, so please excuse it if I occasionally croak. So the question that I have posed myself to try and answer for you is why international humanitarian law matters in outer space. So we just heard from Fred that in terms of cyber warfare, it's kind of trying to anticipate the way warfare might be fought. I would beg to differ slightly, having spent quite a lot of time conversing with military officers who work in Space Command, which is a whole entire division of the Air Force these days, and those who work on cyber operations, that it's actually very much a part of warfare today. And space warfare is something that already exists, perhaps not in the way that we think of in terms of Star Wars and the science fiction, but Star Laws is certainly a reality. And it's not a long time ago in a galaxy far, far away. This is a very common image that you find on the internet, which depicts, it's an artist's depiction, but it depicts the kind of space debris we have flying around us, around Earth. I'm curious if any of you would like to hazard a guess how many operating satellites there are in orbit around Earth at the moment. Thousands? Yeah, so operating satellites, there's about 1,250 operating, providing us services. So your Google Maps to find your way to McGill today, those of you on Facebook, your telecommunications, but many, many other services as well. But next to that, there's about 500,000 trackable pieces of space debris. That is everything from an astronaut's glove, a screw that came off a rocket part, to defunct satellites that have outlived their lifespan, and they're called zombie satellites. There's a lot of science fiction geeks working in this sector, so you get a lot of that kind of reference. And trackable pieces means about the size of a golf ball. And you can imagine next to that, there's probably millions and millions of untrackable pieces, which flying around at the velocity at which they do in orbit cause a huge amount of damage. For those of you who saw the film Gravity a couple of years ago, for all of its Hollywood faults, the premise of that film is very real. Our biggest threat in outer space is not some alien race coming to attack Earth. It's the junk that we've put up there that can cause enormous damage to very expensive and vital infrastructure that's in space. And I mentioned Facebook, email, your telecommunications, GPS, but something like GPS actually has multiple functions which are more important than just looking up Google Maps to find a restaurant. GPS was a military invention to start with, Global Positioning Satellite System, and it's used these days for civilian and military purposes to track the movement of ships on oceans, aviation. Every time you board a plane, you are dependent upon the working of GPS. If it ceased to work, it would be utter chaos in the air and also at landing strips. And every time you make any kind of digital financial transaction, it depends upon GPS for a timestamp to know exactly what funds are being moved where, from where, and at what time. So if there were problems with our GPS, we would also have huge problems with our financial functioning. Essentially, our entire digital existence depends upon satellite technologies. And then there are other services which are very important. Remote sensing is what satellites are doing when they are taking pictures orbiting the Earth. And there's various different orbits which provide different services. So the lower Earth orbits are much better for just if you want to track what's happening, for instance, with environmental change. We can track when disasters start to happen. We can track when a hurricane is about to hit, when you can take a photo of a certain area once every so many hours. We can also track very close to Canada's heart is tracking what's happening around the North Pole with the melting of sea ice. I should mention, actually, Canada has been a leader in satellite technologies throughout the 90s and early 2000s because of how geographically dispersed we are here. Satellite-based telecommunications have been absolutely essential, and also this kind of remote sensing. It's also used for more, much more serious things, like being able to track the movement of refugees. We can tell what's happening in areas of conflict by tracking the movement of people. And sometimes it also helps to gather evidence for international crimes. This is an image on the left taken in January 18th, 2014 in Malakal in South Sudan. And the image on the right was taken on January 27th. And you can see that it's been absolutely razed and destroyed by fire. They're able to track and gather evidence which can be used then in prosecutions and also in responding to these kinds of international crimes. So satellite technology has very important roles to play for us as civilians and also for military uses. I'm going to show you a video here of a test that China did in 2007. Got a really bad soundtrack. In 2007, China launched a missile to destroy one of its old, defunct weather satellites. And it said it was doing this as a way of trying to get rid of some of that space debris that's in the way. If we can find ways of getting rid of the amount of space debris, the image you're seeing right now is the International Space Station. If we can get rid of that space debris, maybe we can solve the problem. So it said that's what it was doing. But when it destroyed its own weather satellite, the space debris that was created was disastrous. It was on a scale that we haven't seen before. This is showing the orbital path of the International Space Station, and the red is the debris that just spread out into multiple orbital trajectories, into millions of tiny pieces. The green, I'm not sure if you can see it there, but the green is a depiction of satellites, and the red is a depiction of this debris that just started to spread out and cause potentially exponential debris. If it hits other bits of debris, it breaks up even more. So it causes a huge problem. It's been signaled as an ASAT test. That's an anti-satellite weapons test. So even though China said they were doing this to try and get rid of a space debris problem, it's been signaled as an ASAT test. And I'm going to say a little bit in a minute about the legality of ASATs. So another reason that I would say Star Wars is already upon us, this is not something of the future. In 2014, Russia launched a series of objects, part of which were communication satellites, and there was a little piece that broke off, as often happens once it reaches a certain orbit, which was assumed by those who can track these kind of events that it was just a piece of space debris, until this little piece of space debris started to make some very interesting maneuvers. And it went and met up with some of the rocket stages from which it was launched and met up with a communications satellite. It was very interesting because at the time, Russia refused to give any information about it. It was during the height of the tensions with the situation in Ukraine. There were a lot of conjecture that this was also a weapons test. If it's possible to have an object that can move around in space and meet up with satellites, it may be able to disable an adversary satellite, cutting out your adversary's ability to have the communications it needs or the GPS tracking that it needs. So we still don't know what that object was. It's object 2014-28E. More than that, we don't know. Another example is the US has a space plane that spent 3 months very secretively in space last year and then returned very quietly. They maintain it was for scientific purposes. There are also huge conjectures that this was a different kind of space weapon. If a plane, it would be robotic, it would be unmanned, but if a space plane could spend that much time up in space and also do maneuvers, you'd have the equivalent of the Russian object. And then, of course, most recently, I'm sure that you've seen in the news that North Korea is asserting that it also has a launch capacity. There have been several failures along the way, but they are launching missiles. One of the problems being the things that we launch objects into space with, those rockets, are all missiles. It's missile technology. Anything you can launch into space is a missile. So if North Korea has the capacity, even for a peaceful space program, it therefore also has a missile capacity, a long-range missile capacity. So I want to say something a little bit about what kinds of military activities there are in space today, here and now, and have been for quite some years. The dawn of the space age in 1957 was actually the dawn of a technological race, you could say a military space race, between the USA and the USSR. In 1957, the space age began. The USSR launched Sputnik with a military missile. They were the first to use one of these long-range missiles as rockets. In 1961, so only a couple of years after, the US had also already managed to develop a satellite and missile observation system. So multiple satellites that were able to communicate with each other, observing what happened on the ground, in order to verify whether or at what stage the USSR's arms program was at. And from the 1960s on, we've had anti-ballistic missiles and ASATs, the kinds that I mentioned before, anti-satellite weapons. This picture up here is Starfish Prime, was a project by the US Air Force. They were testing nuclear explosions in space. And this particular explosion was so bright that it could be seen all across the Caribbean, and it actually completely wiped out everything in the British Virgin Islands and surrounding islands. They had no power, no communications for a couple of days, at which stage the US realized these tests, the kind of impact that even just testing electromagnetic pulse or nuclear explosions in space can actually impact on Earth. And this other one is one of my favorite images. 1963, another American program, they decided if we're doing these nuclear explosions, or if our adversary were to do so in time of conflict, and it wiped out our satellite capabilities, would be really great if we could just send up hundreds of little pieces of copper filament into space, into low orbit, and the signals that we're trying to receive could just bounce off this copper filament. Scientists tried desperately to convince them not to do it because space debris was already seen as a problem in the 1960s. And unfortunately, they went ahead and it was something like 500 million pieces of copper filament that they shot into space, some of which is still flying around, so not the best of programs. And this chart shows today's launching capacity and military space programs. So all of these countries listed here have what we call an indigenous launch capacity. They can launch from their own territory. These are the only ones. So it says here Europe, but what we really mean is France, because any European space program is launched from France. North Korea and South Korea are both listed. And right over on the right, it says space weapons only listed for China, Russia, and the US. But as we'll see a little bit later, it's very difficult to know exactly what's a weapon. See the example of the Russian space object. So the main military activities that we know are known as intelligence, surveillance, and reconnaissance. So this kind of gathering of information by taking photo images, by tracking communications, verifying what other countries are up to with that kind of surveillance and information gathering. And that includes reconnaissance satellites, electronic intelligence gathering systems, so it might not be images, it might be other forms of data being gathered. Early warning systems to know whether another country has launched some kind of long-range weapon. Ocean surveillance, which is also important, not just for environmental climate change tracking, but also to track what movements are happening with naval warships. Radar calibration communications and meteorology, which is also very important if you want to fly airplanes around at high altitudes. So to give a little bit more of the legal side, now that you have the context of why international humanitarian law should matter in space, it's because space is already being used for military purposes and in conflict. The 1967 Outer Space Treaty is one of five core treaties that we have relating to space, and it's kind of the constitutional treaty to do with regulating space. Article 3 of that treaty says that all states parties must carry on all their activities in space in accordance with international law, and then it highlights, including the Charter of the United Nations. It wasn't necessary to highlight that because the Charter is part of international law, but at the time, so this is Cold War negotiations drawing up this treaty, both the USA and the USSR realized that if they wanted to continue their own explorations and use and technological developments in space, they would need to come to some kind of accord with each other. And many other nations, including Canada, signed on to the treaty straight away, knowing that their own developments and capacity would be in the very near future. So the core of it is public international law regulates everything that happens in space. Article 4 is a very key article in terms of the arms race that was taking place at the time. Many people say the Outer Space Treaty could be seen as an arms control treaty. Article 4 says that it is forbidden to place in orbit around the Earth any objects carrying nuclear weapons or any other kinds of weapons of mass destruction, or to install them on the moon or asteroids or planets or anywhere else in space. The problem is, what's a weapon of mass destruction? And does this mean that so-called smart weapons might be lawfully placed in space? And another key provision is that the moon and other celestial bodies, and that means any natural object in space, asteroids, planets, moons, shall be used by all states exclusively for peaceful purposes. And we consider this to be a rule of customary international law now. So even if states have not signed on to this treaty, it's applicable. The peaceful purposes doctrine was an attempt to say we shouldn't weaponize space. We should use space as a domain of exploration and knowledge and furthering human development. Which is not to say that military activities can't take place. And the military will always argue Just recently, Russia has finally agreed. For a long time, it argued that the peaceful purposes doctrine should outlaw any military activities in space, notwithstanding the fact that it was doing just that thing itself. Recently, it's joined most of the rest of the world in saying military activities are allowed as long as they are peaceful. So reconnaissance, surveillance, intelligence is all fine, but anything aggressive is outlawed. So you could think about space and conflict in three physical relationships. One is space to Earth, another is Earth to space, and then there's space to space. Space to Earth is something that we already see used in conflict. In fact, we say that the first space war was not, I'm sure many of you remember, Ronald Reagan's Star Wars program that he wanted to develop a massive satellite shield in space that could respond with lasers to any kind of intercontinental ballistic missiles. They were decades off having that technology at the time, but it was, you know, it was a nice piece of political play. But that was not the first space war. The first space war was the first Gulf War. Operation Desert Storm in Iraq was highly dependent for the first time on these space technologies that I've just been describing. Their ability to communicate with each other, their ability to track the movements of various different parties. It was the first time that space technologies became a highly integral part of the way that modern warfare is fought. Today we know about drones, which are also dependent on signals from satellites. So they often are equipped with cameras. They can send images back up to a satellite, even if they're in Yemen or Afghanistan, to a pilot who's sitting in the US. And the signal that the way the pilot is operating that drone is also through satellite sent signals. So the best way to take out a drone is not to try and fire it down, but to take out the satellite communications capacities which are needed in order to operate it. There was a really great film actually last year that, for want of a better expression, flew under the radar a bit. It was called Good Kill, and it highlighted the way that a very frustrated US Air Force pilot was operating drones. He was frustrated because he couldn't fly and wasn't actually in the combat. But meanwhile, most of the film is actually filmed inside of a container in the Nevada desert from where they're operating drones in Yemen and Afghanistan. And it highlights the way that war crimes were committed, probably one of the reasons why it didn't gain so much popular attention. Many of the weapons used by modern militaries are GPS guided. So although this pilot might drop a bomb at a certain point, these smart bombs will be guided by GPS before detonating. So the weaponization of space is limited by Article 4. As we saw, you can't put weapons of mass destruction in space. You can't put horrible big Star Wars-like weapons in space. But we're already using space for terrestrial warfare. And then we have to think about the potential for Earth to space. So this one is perhaps just on the cusp of what's happening today and perhaps a little bit futuristic. But if we think in terms of anti-satellite technologies, anti-satellite weapons, Fred spoke a bit about kinetic versus non-kinetic. Kinetic basically means physical force between two physical objects, a bomb exploding a plane, for instance. Non-kinetic tends to refer to cyber warfare. It also refers to any other forms of using the media, for instance, or the common term that you hear of winning hearts and minds. So these are also seen as non-kinetic uses of warfare. But in terms of ASATs, I gave the example of North Korea's capacity, of the Chinese test. The US has also done tests very similar, destroying one of its old satellites and causing more space debris. So this Earth to space dimension already exists. It's never been used in a conflict, but we all know that there are many countries who have the capacity to do so. And cyber warfare is a big part of that. Space to space is probably the most futuristic end of the scale. And then I'm not thinking about the sci-fi that we see in Star Wars, but I'm thinking really in terms of how do we define a weapon. So the example I gave of this Russian object that was able to move around, one of the other problems we face due to space debris is how to clean up or mitigate that space debris. It causes problems in terms of safety and security for further human exploration in space. Space tourism is going to be something we see in the next 10 years. And space debris is a problem for that. So there are companies who are investing a lot of time and money in researching how can we clean up space debris. But if you have Clean Space One is one of them, Orbital Recovery. If you have the capacity to do on-orbit servicing, so perhaps to refuel or fix a satellite that is defunct and no longer operational, thereby giving it a longer life, or to capture and remove a satellite, that means you also have the capacity to do so during a conflict to an adversary satellite. Asteroid mining is something that's also very high on space lawyers' list of interest these days. There are companies who say they're only about 10 to 15 years away from being able to land on asteroids, extract minerals, and sell them for trillions of dollars here on Earth. And that's going to create a new competition of resources, which tends to be the basis factor of why we enter conflict. And then one of the key problems, which is why international humanitarian law really matters in space, is that we have dual-purpose technologies. Most of those satellites that are used by us for our civilian telecommunications, finance, all of these kind of things, are the one and the same satellites being used for military purposes. So they have different transponders on them that may be sending some signals and some information to the Canadian Armed Forces and some to you and I, but it's one satellite. So when Fred spoke about the principle of distinction, the problem is identifying whether this satellite is targetable or not. And the growing interdependence as well between civilian and military technologies. Not many systems up there are dedicated military systems. We tend to rely on each other's technologies. So Fred mentioned Jus Ad Bellum. There's also some very key questions around Jus Ad Bellum in space, but I just want to focus now quickly on questions of Jus Ad Bellum in space. The key principles of the law of armed conflict which apply once we have an armed conflict in place are distinction, proportionality, and precaution in attack. So distinction, as Fred outlined, really has to do with identifying what is a targetable object and what are targetable people or which should be protected. So when we come to targeting dual-use satellites, the question of objects, and then the kind of people we think about right now are the status of military astronauts should we come into conflict. The principle of distinction between civilian and military objectives, we take this from the additional protocol to the Geneva Conventions, which was written in 1977. It's considered to be customary law, so even though some states like the US haven't ratified it, it's considered to be applicable law. And it defines military objects as objects which by their nature, location, or purpose, or use, make an effective contribution to military action. So the example that Fred gave, a bridge could sometimes be a military object depending on its purpose or use. An electricity grid, is its nature or its purpose or use, does that make it a military object or not? So the problem with these dual-use satellites is their purpose and use is dual. It's very hard to distinguish whether it would be targetable or not. The principle of precaution then comes into this principle of distinction because in Article 52.3 of the Additional Protocol, it says in a case of doubt, it shall be presumed that an object is not military. We should act with precaution. If we're not sure, we should assume that it's civilian. So this makes it very difficult as China is positioning itself more in space, as North Korea is attempting to prove that it also has space capacities, you know, as these tensions are rising, Russia as well, the best way to impact your adversary in a way that is questionable as to whether or not it's an armed attack is through cyber means and or through targeting a satellite with those cyber means. One contentious issue is that under the law of armed conflict or international humanitarian law, it is completely forbidden to attack, destroy, or render useless objects which are indispensable to the survival of the civilian population. You're not allowed to wipe out crops and livestock for the purpose of starving the civilian population. Which led me to question, and I ask my students this question all the time because some of them have much better knowledge of the technical side of things than I do. Are there services provided by space applications which are indispensable? So beyond Facebook, beyond GPS, even beyond our financial transactions and interactions. And one example that someone gave me was the GPS and satellite operations of a dam. Everything is digitally operated these days. And if you could take out the communications capabilities that were necessary to operate that dam and drain it or flood it or affect civilians, perhaps that would be something completely outlawed by the law of armed conflict. The huge problem, of course, is collateral damage. So we're not talking about harming humans in space. There's only a few of them up there in the International Space Station. We're not talking about human lives. What we're talking about is the impact on our human lives here on Earth, the terrestrial collateral fallout. What exactly would be proportionate if we want to take out an aggressive state's capabilities in space, but we know that it will have a huge impact on their civilian population? When is it disproportionate? And also the potential impact on a neutral state if that satellite that was being targeted also provides services to a state not involved in the conflict. This is where we get a little bit into the it hasn't quite happened yet, but my sense is this is highly likely to take place in the next 5 years. So the status of military astronauts is perhaps not as a cutting question as that of targeting satellites. The principle of distinction in international law, humanitarian law, says you cannot target civilians, you can only target combatants, as Fred described. And we tend to see that based upon are they wearing uniforms, are they openly carrying arms, or are they directly participating in hostilities for a particular period of time. On the other hand, one of our other core space treaties is the Astronaut Agreement, which was drawn up in 1968 following two tragedies that occurred both in the USSR and in the USA. Astronauts died due to various failures, and it was agreed if something like this were to happen, if Russian astronauts were even to land upon American territory, even during the Cold War, they were willing to say, astronauts should be considered envoys of humankind. What they're doing is such high risk, and it's really bringing our scientific development so much further that even in times of conflict, they should be considered protected people. We're not quite sure what will happen in times of hostilities. Which of these two laws will assert itself as lex specialis, as the law that should prevail over the other? It's probably, I would say, and it doesn't matter if an astronaut is actually participating in hostilities, I would say that's probably not the question we're going to have to deal with first. It's going to be questions of targeting. All of it links into proportionality. As I mentioned, what is the proportion? What is disproportionate fallout for us here on Earth if satellites are targeted? And then precaution in attack is the final principle, which brings me back to the question of the legality of anti-satellite weapons. Article 4 of the Outer Space Treaty only prohibits weapons of mass destruction. What about so-called smart weapons? Are they prohibited? What about the effect, as I mentioned, not only in terms of space debris, but also in terms of impacting us? The question of space debris also comes under the arm of environmental law that we consider applicable in international humanitarian law. Article 35(3) of the Additional Protocol says that it's unlawful to employ methods or means of warfare which are intended or may be expected to cause widespread, long-term, and severe damage to the environment. And this was drawn up thinking in terms of napalm destruction of the physical environment. But given that we know what kind of impact destruction of satellites will have in terms of creating more space debris, we know it's expected to cause widespread, long-term, and severe damage to the space environment. The question is, does that outlaw the use of ASATs? Most states at the moment would say, no, it doesn't. It just says we have to limit the ways in which we use ASATs. Proportionality actually says that where we can use cyber methods of warfare, we should. because probably the physical destruction is going to be far less. And the manual that Fred mentioned right at the end of his presentation actually says we should prefer cyber warfare, cyber means as a means of warfare. But given that that involves the fallout if you interfere with or disable even temporarily a satellite that all of us are dependent on, maybe that proportionality question pulls back a little bit on the use of cyber warfare and the use of peaceful space objects as weapons. So there's a registration convention, one of the other core space treaties, which says that every single thing that's launched has to be registered both in a national registry and with the UN Office of Outer Space Affairs. And yes, that is a thing that exists. Once again, we don't really know whether Russia is telling us everything it's launching or what it is. We don't really know if what North Korea is launching is actually meant for a peaceful space program. They can tell us that and they can register it as such, but there's no way of identifying or verifying whether that's the case. And that's where I end my circuitry of the Earth and why international humanitarian law matters in space.
We will have a 10 minutes break. It's 7:21 and back in the room at 7:30. Je vais vous demander de reprendre vos places, s'il vous plaît. Please take your seats. I will now ask Tania Krupi to join the podium for the second half of the conference. Tania.
Good evening, and thank you very much. It's wonderful to have all of you here, and it's also an exciting opportunity for us to share what we are doing with a wider audience, because so often we just end up reading articles and sometimes talking to each other on legal topics. Most of the time we actually don't discuss legal topics, we talk about other stuff. So it's great to be here with you. And my presentation is going to be on the technology of what are known as killer robots. So these are, and this technology doesn't exist yet, but these are robots which would make decisions without human control, and they would choose targets on the battlefield and attack them. So I will start my prezi, and actually I would ask you to please keep the timing, because I actually don't have a clock in front of me. Okay, thank you. So in terms of what has been happening, I would like to start with a personal story. I was doing my master's in 2007 and 2008 in public international law. And it was a really interesting experience, because at the time I was fascinated by this issue of whether the armed forces have to assume risk to themselves in order to reduce danger to civilians. And the reason why I was so excited about this question was because NATO was flying at high altitudes in order for the pilot to be safe from the air defense systems of the enemy. And needless to say, I applied to a PhD program with this topic in mind. And the issue of drones was it started to be written about around that time, and I thought that that was such a huge breakthrough. I mean, we had unmanned aircraft with no pilots in them operating and being used as a tool to collect intelligence and pick out targets. And guess what? A few years later, maybe one or two, and another issue came up, which is, as you can see, the purple robot, well, the issue of what are called in the legal technical language lethal autonomous robots. And I figured that it would be better to call them killer robots. Why am I telling you this little biography? Well, this is because this technology may seem like a far, far away thing, but in my experience, you should never be too sure about your intuitive impressions. You really don't know what the scientists will come up with and how soon. So I think that we should think about this technology as a realistic possibility, as opposed to a sci-fi notion that the scientists are really excited about and that they hope to develop someday. So in terms of definitions, I thought that it is really interesting to look at how countries define them. Because if you look at the definition by the US Department of Defense, they basically define killer robots as a system which, once activated, autonomously selects targets and engages them. However, if you look at the UK military doctrine, they say that this technology involves a robot functioning to the same degree of accuracy as a human being. So this means that if there is a robot which is capable, which has artificial intelligence that enables it to make decisions, but which doesn't function to the same level as a human, well, it means that it's really not a lethal autonomous robot as far as the United Kingdom is concerned. And before I move in on with my presentation, I wanted to screen a little video which I think gives a really good context to what is happening and the debates that are going around this technology.
Drones have already raised questions about 21st century warfare, but while they have no pilots, they are controlled by humans on the ground. A human finger is on the trigger. Not so with lethal autonomous robots. They are programmed in advance. On the battlefield, they, not people, will decide what to destroy or who to kill. A prospect that worries human rights experts.
Is it acceptable from the perspective of protecting life and human dignity that any kind of weapon that is used to kill humans, whether in peace or in war, will be controlled by autonomous robots?
The technology is racing ahead of the moral questions. Can a robot distinguish between military targets and civilians, between soldiers who are still fighting and those who want to surrender? And who is accountable if something goes wrong? Because robots can't be prosecuted for war crimes. The UN wants answers before robots get any closer to the battlefield.
War without reflection is mechanical slaughter. It is my considered opinion that in the same way that the taking of any human life deserves as a minimum some deliberation, the decision to allow machines to be deployed to kill human beings worldwide, whatever weapons they use, deserves a collective pause, in other words, a moratorium.
The United States, Britain and Israel are all believed to be developing autonomous robots. Their response to the call for a moratorium was non-committal. Meanwhile, human rights groups would like to go further. As in the case of blinding lasers, they would like lethal robots banned worldwide before they ever get to the battlefield. Imogen Folks, BBC News, Geneva.
So the states are actually currently using the United Nations as a venue for discussing this technology and how to proceed with it. And I have identified the general categories into which states fall into in terms of their views on this technology. So we have the Holy See and Costa Rica, which have said that they want this technology to be banned before it's even developed. Then we have Switzerland, which says that this technology may be developed, but there should always be a human being controlling the robot. We also have the European Union countries, Ecuador, Egypt, Japan, Madagascar, Mexico, Pakistan, and the Ukraine, which say that there should be a treaty which is concluded and which restricts the circumstances in which such robots are used. So, for instance, I would imagine that if you are in a desert, there aren't many civilians who can be confused for military targets. Currently, they're mainly nomadic tribes, but these are who may be encountered. This is not a really widespread occurrence, for instance. Or we may have the high seas where it's easier to track ships from different countries. So we are not really talking, for instance, about a city where we have civilians intermingled with the soldiers, where it may be very difficult to track and distinguish civilians from the enemy. And finally, we have the UK, the US, and Russia, who say that there may well come a point when they use this technology, but I think what they're really saying is that this technology will be used. So if you take the UK, at the end of this year, the armed forces will have a military exercise with robotic technology. And we also have, for instance, Russia, which said that it will use robots in military operations. And then the US is pretty much investing a lot of money into making this technology a reality. When it comes to the reaction of experts, interestingly enough, there are lots of experts in robotics and artificial intelligence who think that this technology should not be developed. So we have the Icelandic Institute for Intelligent Machines, which issued a policy saying that it will not conduct research into applications which will be used on the battlefield. We have a Canadian company, ClearPath, that said that it will not develop robots with artificial intelligence which have military applications. We have the Engineer magazine, which conducted a survey among engineers gauging their reaction to this technology, and 76% of engineers said that they think that this technology should not be developed or used. We have more than 100,000 experts who are leaders in their field who gathered together at the International Joint Conference on Artificial Intelligence in Buenos Aires, Argentina, and who called for a ban on this technology. We even have military spokespersons who are very reluctant and very skeptical about this technology. So we have former Major General Robert H. Latief and Patrick McCloskey, who said, and I quote, "When robots rule warfare, utterly without empathy or compassion, humans retain less intrinsic worth than a toaster, which at least can be used for spare parts." Now, I don't mean to quote these people in order to say that everybody is against this technology. That's just simply not true. So, for instance, Ronald Arkin is a leading roboticist who has been commissioned by the U.S. Department of Defense to invent robots which are capable of complying with the law. He thinks that it's possible to develop robots which are capable to distinguish situations which raise ethical concerns from situations which don't. And actually, he argues that robots could be better than soldiers. So, for example, a robot would not be nervous, wonder whether the person is perhaps an enemy, and pull the trigger just because the soldier is really afraid for his or her life and just decides to kill another individual rather than take the risk that the person is in fact a lawful target. Then we have the issue of war crimes. So soldiers, they commit rape. There have been cases in Afghanistan where soldiers mutilated the bodies of the Afghan fighters, and the explanation for that given by, I guess, by the US officials is that they're just very traumatized psychologically from seeing their colleagues die, and that they experience so much mental trauma that it impacts their ability to handle stress, and that's why they go out and commit this kind of acts. Now, I just wanted to talk to you about advantages and disadvantages of this technology, because there are both. So in terms of advantages, there are military reasons for why the armed forces may want to use this technology. So one robot can use can have more effect on the battlefield than a single soldier. So that means that you could have perhaps five robots performing in the same way as 10 soldiers. Another positive effect of using robots is that you can conduct a military operation over a wider area and deploy them from a long distance on short notice, so you have a really mobile, flexible force. Another good aspect is that there are fewer soldier casualties and also fewer soldiers who get injured and who may have lifetime disabilities. As I already mentioned, robots have no desire for self-preservation, so potentially they will make decisions in a much more uniform manner than human beings. Surprisingly, or not surprisingly, they are cheaper to maintain than the armed forces, so it means that you need to spend potentially a lot of money in order to buy them, but once you have them, you just need to maintain and repair them, whereas with humans, potentially, they are on support from the government for the rest of their lives due to having disabling injuries. Another argument is that of transparency in decision making. So you can record how the robot made a decision, you can review it, and then see whether the robot had good grounds for reaching its decision and complied with the law. Whereas with humans, it's really hard to control how soldiers are making decisions in the heat of the battle. The battle is often very chaotic. And so we really just rely on good faith conduct, and then there's a tendency to prosecute only when things go really, really wrong, and there is an investigation. I have a quote from the CEO of a South Korean company called Dodam. His name is Myung Kwang Chang. I think it's an interesting illustration of the advantages of robots. He says, "Our weapons don't sleep like humans must. They can see in the dark because they have thermal cameras, like humans can't. Our technology therefore plugs the gaps in human capability." And the reason why I have this quote is because there are many arguments in favor of this technology which focus on their superiority in comparison to humans. Now, in terms of disadvantages, well, as you can imagine, robots, like any technology, they can be hacked. So the enemy could take control over the robot, and then we don't really know what happens next because it all depends on what the enemy decides to do with the robot. There's also the risk of the degradation of computer code. So if you owned a laptop for many years, like I did, my previous one lasted for 7 years, what you notice is that after a while, it gets slow, it doesn't really function as well, and that's because through being used, the computer code gets degraded. So there are small changes, and eventually the small changes accumulate, and you either need to completely reboot your system, or you need someone with great skills to go and do some programming for you, and then your computer basically gets better. There's also the potential to malfunction, like with any technology. So I'm sure you encountered your computer freezing on you or just not performing as intended. And sometimes all you need to do is to reload it in good cases scenarios. And sometimes you have more serious problems where you end up replacing parts or rewriting the code or whatnot. There are also ethical concerns. So the Holy See, for instance, said that in the same way as the UN Special Rapporteur, that it's really troubling when you have a human being removed from the decision to kill another human being. From a legal point of view, robots are potentially controversial, and I will talk about it in more detail later on. And I just wanted to also point out that you have roboticists who signed a petition in which they warned that warlords could use this technology to perpetrate ethnic cleansing. And there's also a potential of dictator states using this technology to subdue their populations. And as you can imagine, robots have much more endurance than police officers, and they just could be used in a much more effective ways to achieve those kind of goals. So now I just want to talk about robotic technologies which are already in use, because there are some that are used. One of them is called the Israeli Harop. So this is a technology which automatically searches for enemy targets which emit radar signals, and then it attacks them. At the moment, it is used with human controllers supervising the system. There's another technology which has been invented in South Korea and is used to police the demilitarized zone with North Korea. So you essentially have sentry robots. They detect body heat. When they do so, they communicate with commanders, and then commanders rely on cameras to figure out whether it's a soldier or a civilian, and then they can remotely authorize their robot to engage the target. There are also underwater technologies. So we have the MK-60 Captor Mine, which detects the acoustic signatures of submarines and ships. And based on those acoustic signatures, it can tell apart friendly submarines from enemy submarines and ships. And the newest technology, which is really fresh off the assembly line, is a Lockheed Martin long-range anti-ship missile. So what it does is that it detects enemy radar emissions, and then it calculates how to avoid them in order not to be detected. And in doing so, it's able to get to the target and engage it without being shot down. So this is as far as we got so far. Now I just want to talk to you a bit about where we are heading. So the US, the UK, Russia, China, and Israel, they all have researchers working on developing this technology. And we, at the moment, we have some software with which you can engage in a conversation, and it can give you answers which approximate the answers which a human being would give, and you wouldn't even know whether you are speaking to a machine or not. But of course, this is a product of careful programming. Then we have in the US, we have DARPA, which is essentially the US funded agency which conducts research into future military technologies. And they are investigating how monkeys visually recognize and classify objects. And they are hoping that by simulating the primate visual system, they will understand how a human brain identifies and classifies objects. And there is even talk about developing artificial brains. So roboticists define artificial brains as machines which have the same intelligence, self-awareness, and creativity as human beings. Now, when you ask Dr. Kenyon, who is working for DARPA, how realistic it is to have this kind of brain, he thinks that this technology will be developed pretty soon, which is quite an ambitious statement. And there are other scientists who think that it will take 50 to 100 years to develop an artificial brain. But we also have scientists like Sharkey, who is very prominent and who actually knows not only computer science but also law, who says that we really have to have something unexpected happen in science, a breakthrough, in order to invent this technology. So to quote him, it may be computationally intractable to develop an artificial brain. And there are goals which are less ambitious. Basically, scientists want to develop a robot with artificial intelligence which could be exposed to different scenarios. And then the robot would learn from experience, and then eventually it is hoped that the robot will make the kind of decisions which we want the robot to make. But I just want to explain that actually our life is quite complex and unstructured. It means that never will you encounter in life two identical scenarios. So, for instance, last year there may have been a lecture on technologies in this lecture hall, but there would have been a different number and combination of attendees. So because there are no two situations in life which are ever identical, I doubt that you could have a robot which was trained from experience who could actually respond in the same way as a human, just because the world is really complex, and sometimes you cannot really learn all the complexities by mechanical processes. But that's just my views and the views of some other scholars, which I would encourage you to take with a grain of salt. So now I'd like to move on to considering legal issues. And the first area which I picked is international humanitarian law, simply because the first application will be in the context of an armed conflict. I know that previous speakers explained to you what international humanitarian law is, but I will just remind you very briefly. It applies once an armed conflict has begun, and it protects the natural environment, civilians, individuals who do not take part in hostilities, such as journalists, but also soldiers. And of course, the considerations for protecting civilians or relief personnel are very different than for protecting soldiers. And we have different sets of rules. But I think it is safe to say that apart from perhaps animal rights, this regime is pretty comprehensive in addressing different needs. The rules which are most relevant to our context are called the rules of targeting. They regulate how commanders plan and go about conducting military operations. I picked the principal distinction because I think it's a good starting point for discussion. So as my colleagues explained earlier, it requires that fighters distinguish at all times between civilians and lawful targets. Now, the interesting part is not just that these rules were drafted with human decision makers in mind. What is much more interesting is that in order to apply this rule, you need to have human-like qualities. So to recognize who is a civilian and who is combatant is not very simple, precisely because, as Frederick explained, we don't really have a situation anymore where we have the two states fighting, each with an army, with soldiers wearing a uniform. The much more common scenario presently is that you have an enemy who doesn't wear a uniform and doesn't wear a distinctive sign, so no armband, no headgear, and nothing else which would distinguish them from civilians. Moreover, we have countries such as Afghanistan where it's customary for adult males to carry a gun. And so it's just really, really tough to even know whether you have an insurgent or a civilian in front of you, just because all men dress in the same way, a lot of them have guns. And so just to explain what kind of human qualities you would need in order to be able to tell apart civilians from fighters, we have Colonel Darren Stewart, who explains that we intuition, experience-based analysis, and cognitive functions are really important for making sense of information. So as far as the military is concerned, when you look around yourself, it's really not intelligence. It's just information. In order to be valuable, that information has to be converted into intelligence. And in order to understand what features are important for your decision, you need experience, you need judgment and cognitive processes. We have Peter Azaro, who is more of a philosopher, and who says that, again, we need interpretive judgment in order to be able to make these kind of decisions. We also have Patrick Lynn, George Becky, and Keith Abney, who say, who rightly point out that robots need to detect situations which raise ethical concerns on the battlefield. So to give you an example, you can have a soldier who is helping civilians to evacuate. And some civilians may be very vulnerable, such as pregnant women or individuals who are sick or individuals who are elderly. And although legally speaking you can target a uniformed member of the armed forces at any time, ethically speaking, we really want to give civilians a chance to flee a conflict zone, so we may prefer to delay the decision to kill someone because that individual is actually helping someone else. Some issues, they cross ethical and legal concerns. So, for example, from an ethical point of view, you wouldn't target an injured enemy, and in fact that is legally prohibited. So there are some situations where the two cross over. We also have Human Rights Watch, which is a non-governmental organization, and Robert Sparrow, who points out that actually to make these decisions we need emotions and compassion and an ability to understand what another person is experiencing. And actually, Lieutenant Colonel York Welbrink also agrees with them, being a military person, that actually feelings, empathy, and intuition are really important for decision-making. And I just have an example to illustrate why that might be the case. So imagine that you have a village in Afghanistan that has a water tower. Now, if that water tower is used for observation, it becomes a military target, so you can attack it. Now, imagine that there is a man with a gun who climbs on that water tower, and it is known that there are tensions between tribes, and this is just an imaginary scenario, and there had been instances where some tribes perpetuated ethnic cleansing against other tribes. And the reason why I picked Afghanistan is because, as I mentioned earlier, it's customary there for all adult men to carry guns. Now, if you have empathy and if you have intuition and judgment, you may figure out, well, actually that man could be a civilian who is really terrified that the village may be attacked again, and he could be very vigilant and just go every hour and check what is happening around in the vicinity to make sure that he can notify his community about a possible attack so that they could either protect themselves or escape. Of course, there could be another possibility that individual is in fact a fighter, and that there are fighters in that village who are preparing a military operation against one's own fighters. The question is this: will a robot be able to go through that reasoning process and pause before attacking an armed man who climbed a water tower? Now I just want to move to international human rights law. There is a possibility that killer robots could be used in domestic law enforcement operations. Interestingly enough, the issues being raised in human rights law cross-cut with international humanitarian law. But before we get there, I just wanted to explain the current state of technology. So at the moment, we are very close to having drones, which could be programmed to look for particular individuals, and they would have facial recognition software. Now, that technology is not foolproof. So if someone were to wear sunglasses, then it would be, and a beard, for instance, and to have a beard, it would be harder for the robot to map the face and figure out who the individual is. And to be really futuristic, there are all kinds of technologies you could come up with to counter the ability of the drone to recognize faces. So for instance, there could be maybe contact lenses which have special chips in them which deflect particular equipment. The possibilities we really don't know yet. But the fact is that there are precursors which are being developed. So in terms of human rights law, there are very strict limitations on when you can use lethal force in a domestic context. So first of all, the use of force must be absolutely necessary. And that usually happens when there is a threat to someone else's life or to the life of a law enforcement official. It could also take place when someone who was lawfully arrested is trying to escape, for instance, from prison. And not only should the use of force be necessary, but it should be proportional. And The proportionality definition here is different than in international humanitarian law. What it means is that the police officers should use no more force than is absolutely necessary to achieve their goal. So it means that they are equipped with various equipment to make sure that they can use an escalated approach. It also means that they may use tasser guns instead of lethal weapons. And although tasser guns carry risks, such as a heart attack, they still are not like lethal weapons. But the situation here is that you also need to be able to exercise judgment to know, A, when the use of force is necessary, and B, well, how much force is it necessary to use in the circumstances? This is a subjective judgment. And I also wanted to quote Human Rights Watch, which says, "Fully autonomous weapons could undermine the principle of dignity, which implies that everyone has a worth deserving of respect. As inanimate machines, fully autonomous weapons could truly comprehend neither the value of individual life nor the significance of its loss." And the next area which I will cover really briefly is international criminal law, which is designed to make sure that there is accountability when international crimes such as genocide, crimes against humanity, war crimes and torture are committed. And it's structured in such a way that civilian and military superiors have a duty to take steps to prevent their subordinates from committing crimes and to punish them when they do so. The problem is that, again, there are all these assumptions about human relationships. For instance, this doctrine doesn't apply unless there is a subordinate who commits a crime with mens rea or intent. And it's really hard to see how a robot is capable of having intent. So if a robot malfunctions and kills a civilian, well, there is no war crime. So this doctrine of command responsibility would not be applicable. So that's, you know, that's one of the paradoxes, which can be overcome. So we have Anders Sandberg, who said, "A truly self-learning system could learn different values and theories of what appropriate actions to do. And if it could reflect on itself, it might become a real moral agent in the philosophical sense." But what I would like to leave you with is this question, well, are we capable of having these robots? So he goes on to say, well, even if we expose them to our real life scenarios, we don't really know what the robot will learn. And what inferences it will make from the situations to which it is exposed. And robots are going to be very complex. There will be many individuals working on developing them, and no single individual will know every single line of code that is being written, and this means that it's not possible to make sure that there are no unexpected interactions. I'm not sure whether there will be a program which will be able to scan all those lines of codes and figure out whether they all work together really well. Maybe there will be, but I think that there are lots of persuasive arguments being made in favor and against this technology, and I think that we really have to think about what we are being told and how these kind of systems will function and how reliable they will be, especially because potentially there is a $1 billion market for these kinds of technologies. So thank you very much.
Je vais laisser à Maître Eric Ward les mots de la fin. Merci Eric d'avoir fait le déplacement d'Ottawa pour nous ce soir. Thank you.
Thank you. I do work for the Government of Canada, and at the outset I need to explain that my views and anything that I'm going to express is not a position of the Government of Canada. In fact, it's not even the kind of thinking that I'm paid for, and as I proceed you'll see how unlikely it is that anyone would pay for the kind of thinking that I'm about to present to you this evening. But please, in case you ever speak to anybody who works with me, mention that I did make the disclaimer. So I should start with a story. We're almost through the night. I think you've received already good value for your money and for your training time. So I'll start with a story about something that happened to me today, a conversation I had on the road from Ottawa to Montreal. And that is, I was pulled over on the way here by a giant robotic sphinx. Now, I had not heard that the Sécurité de Québec had deployed such machines, but nonetheless, I'm a law-abiding person. I rolled down the window and asked, with as much confidence as I could, what seems to be the problem? Officer. The Sphinx said, Eric Ward. I'm a killer robot sent from the future to save humanity from the chain of events set in motion by your speech at McGill tonight. I said, fiddlesticks. It's a great speech. And it's entitled Encoding Norms for Moral Robots. And in it, I show how the important rules of personal capacity, contract, property, and human rights from both civil and common traditions, of course, I studied at McGill, first of all, can be harmonized, rationalized, and then reduced to a series of sufficiently precise algorithms such that they can be injected in the soon-to-arrive robots, making them fully moral and ushering in a well-ordered utopia governed automatically by the rule of law, so that we lawyers can finally have the rest and relaxation and lives of leisure that we've been promised ever since the invention of the washing machine and the articling student. The Sphinx winced and said, Eric, there is a PhD student in the audience who will take your ideas more seriously than they deserve. She will perfect and refine your approach, and with funding from a major military defense research program, create Legis Alpha, the world's first multi-domain artificial legal intelligence that will dominate the planet and lead to the inhuman future from which I have been sent to stop you. I took a good look at the Sphinx. I'm not easily deterred by giant robotic sphinxes, and then objected, I can't believe I'm having an argument with you. Look at you. You're ridiculous. You're a walking cliche. Here you come with the Terminator backstory, the robotic lion body, fantasy film angel wings, generic airbrushed young woman's face on a metal mesh head with blinking lights in the back, and inexplicable silver bust in a steampunk bikini like you get from on science fiction books of the 1970s. You're just an assemblage of tropes, and you're not a very interesting one at that. I'm not going to listen to what you say. The Sphinx made a Hollywood Best Supporting Actor trademark sad smile. Again, a cliche. It said, Eric, that is the point. In my future, law has achieved closure. Any part of us that did not fit on the bed frame of your law was amputated. The problem is not that all your ideas are wrong. It's that they can be made descriptively right at a terrible cost. I realize that my little speech here is itself a cliche, and that I've just badly paraphrased Hannah Arendt, and that it's impossible to really take me seriously. But that is just further to my point. This is the creation of the world that you are about to speak to. I was undeterred still. First of all, I had a commitment to speak, and I wasn't about to turn that down at my alma mater. Sphinx, I said, given that you must clearly adhere to pre-established cliches and norms, I would like you to pose me a riddle. And if I solve this riddle, I'm going to be allowed to proceed and give my speech as I promised. Oh, you people, said the Sphinx, always with the Oedipus thing. Okay, because of the way you speak, I have designed a riddle that you will certainly not solve. Imagine that you're in a steel box, welded shut on all sides, with no openings of any kind, and you have no tools with you that could help. How do you get out? Sphinx said it a second time. Imagine you're a steel box, and so on and so on. How do you get out? But I smiled, because I have children. And they challenged me at the breakfast table with just the same riddle. In the end, of course, they had to tell me the answer. I wouldn't have got it. Sphinx, I said, the solution to your problem of how to get out of this box, imagine you're a steel box, is to stop imagining that you're in a steel box. The Sphinx was crushed. I had a momentary delight at besting the Sphinx, but it dissolved as soon as the truth of the riddle hit home. And I didn't feel it in my brain, the part of me that had organized this whole speech, that had synthesized, in fact, crystallized all of civil and common law and other traditions that H.P. Glenn would have taught to me. But in my heart and in my gut, the place is so rarely reached by the kind of sci-fi thinking and imagination about the technologies that we're discussing tonight, although there's some notable exceptions, Ursula Le Guin and Kim Stanley Robinson in the recent book. Sphinx, I said, I've won the right to proceed down the road, but I intend to give a different speech now, one that would give pause to this PhD student of whom you speak. The only problem is I already gave the title that I already explained you to Professor Moyes, so that's going to be difficult for me. No problem, said the Sphinx. I'll just go a little bit back further in time and have it changed for you. So, colleagues, the new title of my talk is Killer Robots and Other Targets of the Legal Imagination. The way I'm going to explore this is to show a few different ways that the title plays. How is it that these killer robots that we've been hearing about play in what we all carry around with us already, which is the legal imagination? A trained and a specific kind of imagination. I'm also going to hit a number of different ways, three points that I think are really the direction finders for us confronted with these kinds of technologies. The first is, you have to think of code as law. You have to think of the code to this point, animates everything electronic that we've ever created as a species of law, as a species of regulation. This opens up huge vistas for the legal imagination because it gives us a new playground. Second, the best way to focus, I think, on these questions and to start advancing the legal imagination is to notice that what's at stake and the most important questions are not about the technology, but about our own humanity. And I think that's come out in several of the speeches already today. And the third is, we don't know. We do not know. And anybody who tells you that they know or they can forecast accurately how robots will be deployed, what kind of artificial intelligence exists, what kind of laws will work or will not work, those are the only certainty is that they don't know either. We do not know, and so we're proceeding under huge ignorance. So let's talk first about how the legal imagination can target killer robots. Well, the first way is as a target of regulation, an object that the legal imagination can project norms onto, to control, to humanize, to make moral, to somehow make safe this thing that we don't know about that seems possible. And I note two political projects, and you might have heard of them. First, I think you spoke about the campaign to ban killer robots. There's a second one, which hasn't achieved as much play in Canada, but achieved quite a bit of play in the UK, which is a campaign to ban sex robots. And so now I've brought violence and sex into your primetime experience. I hope that's waking everyone up. And in some curious ways, both of them call on the same kind of regulatory response, and both of them raise the same kind of issues. Now, in an excellent forthcoming chapter, and I don't want to say too much about it because I saw a preprint online, but it's coming out in a book, I think, next week or on the 29th. Ian Kerr and Katie Zelazgi, Ian Kerr of U of O, they review the case for and against the lethal autonomous robots, and I think you've heard a good presentation of that already. So I'm going to skip through what their analysis is, but this comes out in favor of a ban. What they don't claim, or what they don't oppose necessarily, is that any of the pros presented in favor of lethal autonomous robots are false. They admit that we don't know. We don't know what could be encoded, and we don't know what kind of norms or capacities they could operate on. Instead, they turn back to what I said about focusing on our humanity, and they ask, look, what kind of war, forget about what they can do in present warfare situations, but what kind of war does this bring upon us? What are the conditions of war, and in particular of dehumanization, with taking humans out of the loop that this brings on? And they make a very strong argument, at least in favor of a temporary ban. I'm not optimistic, though. I'm not optimistic in part because of the future of our attempts to put hard bans on technologies that serve powerful interests and that solve difficult problems, and in particular, technologies that increase power and increase velocity. So let's go way back to the Red Flag Acts that required of 1865. Does anyone know about the Red Flag Act and what the Red Flag Act was about? This was a UK act that was meant to control the terrifying technology of its time, the horseless carriage, or essentially large kind of hybrid truck trains powered by steam that would drag carts along through the cobblestone streets. Now, the Locomotive Act, 1865, known as the Red Flag Act, was in a sense draconian. It was as close to a hard ban, at least on the utility of such a technology, as you can imagine. So they set speed limits for the cars of the time of 4 miles per hour in the country and 2 miles per hour in town. They weren't banned, but they were very, very slow. They also stipulated that self-propelled vehicles should be accompanied by a crew of 3 persons, a driver, a stoker, okay, that makes sense, and a man with a red flag walking 60 yards ahead of each vehicle at a walking pace. Of course, that's not hard when it's going 2 miles per hour in towns. At a walking pace, and the man must have a red flag or lantern to warn horse riders and horse-drawn traffic of the approach of a self-propelled machine. So look, it looked like momentum was in favor, the legislative momentum was in favor of controlling this terrifying technology, and I'm making light of it, but it was a terrifying technology. That was not what people expected in their social world. It's not what they expected on their streets, and it wasn't a reality that they had encountered before. And so you might say, they were off to a good start. The technology was under control. Now let's sort of zip back to our time. What happened to that ban, to that desire to control? Well, first of all, the Red Flag Acts were largely repealed in 1896, so not much later. And instead, the law started to change. The law started to change in order to make the roads and the turnpikes and the turns and the crosswalks safe for these horseless carriages, safe for these machines, and to pave the way for an emerging automobile industry in the UK, which was part of one of the elements of the broad industrial transformation, and of course the beginning of empire. Well, not the beginning, but the industrial phase of empire. Now look, there are many ways to think about this Red Flag Act as a regulatory response, and it bears reflection on how we might respond to killer robots today. First, it did provide warning and notice. That's an important part. It involved slowing down, handicapping, giving people a chance to at least get used to some of this technology, and a chance perhaps to think a little bit more about how it would be deployed. And then there was arguably an economic play here by the interests associated with animal-powered transport, and that was quite a decent-sized economic interest. So think of this as a kind of taxi normative restrictions on Uber, or maybe on driverless competition issued by Apple or Google. But there might be something else at play here that would be relevant to our own understanding of our own legal imagination and how we're drawn to see these objects as targets of regulation. They may have played into a desire to represent the traction force of these new machines as if they are somehow controllable, humanized, literally to insist that these technologies conform to the limitations and shape and time signature of the human body and the velocity of human life as it had been understood even up to that point in the Industrial Revolution. Where did the red flags humans go? Well, now, if you wanted to get out on the highway between Ottawa and Montreal, it would be a criminal offense, a traffic offense, for a human to be out there warning others about the dangers of these machines. It's become so transparent to us that, in fact, the roads belong to that mode of transit, to that kind of machine, that it's almost unthinkable to imagine a regulatory perspective that really wanted a walking human in the loop. But what if we saw the man waving the red flag not as a regulatory add-on, but as a temporary part of the evolution of motor technology? And that way he'd be less like a safety supervisor and more like a salesman or a conductor for one of the set of floats in a long parade that had been going on ever since humans began making tools. The job of this conductor is to attract attention and notice to the motorized vehicle, convince people that it is humanized, it is controllable, it's coming, but it's manageable. But why was this particular float so attractive, so worthy of legislation? Well, perhaps because the horseless carriage and the street locomotive were embodiments of a terrifying translation, and one that we might recognize today. The machines that had transformed Britain's cities in the beginning decades of the Industrial Revolution seemed to have escaped their bounds. Okay? It's as though the mechanical loom, as though the spirit of mechanization itself, had unlocked itself from the factory floor and was now roaming about in the social space that was previously the domain of humans and domesticated animals. Might that not be the way, our way of seeing our fascination with humanoid robots? Like, why do we think that robots are going to look like this strange evolved hominid, but armed with lethal autonomous robots? Well, it might be because we are shocked to see computer intelligence, that post-industrial phase of development, becoming unmoored itself from the floor of the server room, to see it climb out of the cell phones in our pockets, and to see it walking the earth in a social space that was previously the domain of humans, our domesticated animals, our industrial machinery, and our consumer goods. We always thought we were lonely until there was someone else. So how many have seen the Atlas, the videos of the Atlas robot? It's part of a DARPA development project, Boston Dynamics, I think. Really Google this, but make sure it's a 2016 video, Boston Dynamics, is it Boston Dynamics? Atlas robot, and I really hope this is not a kind of Ayn Rand thing that they named it after, but yeah, I know. But so just notice what your legal imagination does when you see Atlas now, a human-shaped robot has now become untethered. The previous test kind of had a tether, and it was awkward, and when they would kick it, it would fall over. You felt sort of sorry for it when you saw those videos. But now Atlas can walk, and not just walk on flat plains, but walk through the woods. This is really a fascinating video of Atlas walking through the woods autonomously without a tether, not connected in any way to any physical support system, and managing the environment. I think this is some of maybe the if you watch that, you'll feel some of the shock that led to the red flag acts, and you might imagine how we might respond. But, you know, these humanoid visions of robots, I think, might be a little bit misleading. We should prepare our imagination and our legal imagination for the possibility of what Bruce Scheer, a computer security researcher, has recently called world-sized robots. What he's saying is that the networks of sensors, of processors, and actuators, the Internet of Things, things that can change in the physical environment, are being increasingly networked together and when added, you know, when a complex artificial intelligence might be added to it, that you might have robots or intelligence that exist in the layers of cyberspace that are not even visible to us. They won't be walking through the, oh, look, I'm out on a walk and there's Atlas. No, it'll be the power of this kind of technology is that the robots and the code that they're built on recedes into the background of our social reality. So my suggestion here is that we can go from looking at robots as objects of regulation to think about, why are they particularly the target of our fascination? And I've said that I think that's perhaps because we are experiencing the initial shock of what some are hailing as the evolution of cognitive computing, of artificial intelligence, physically in the world, and doing things that are recognizable to us. Now, how many here are familiar with the kind of exciting and terrifying notion of the singularity? Yes? Okay. The singularity is it's a future proposed event that follows an insight actually of I.J. Goode, who's one of the characters, of course, surrounding Turing in the most recent movie. And he wrote in 1965 this simple and yet penetrating prose. Let an ultra-intelligent machine be defined as a machine that can far surpass all the intellectual activities of any man, however clever. Since the design of machines is one of these intellectual activities, an ultra-intelligent machine could design even better machines. There would then be unquestionably an intelligence explosion, and the intelligence of man would be left far behind. Thus, the first ultra-intelligent machine is the last invention that man need ever make, provided that the machine is docile enough to tell us how to keep it under control. The logic is actually quite strong, and it raises the question of, I guess what it puts in front of us the largest we don't know, which is that we don't know if this is an impossibility and there's something physically or calculably impossible with producing general domain artificial intelligence, or whether it's something that is maybe around the corner in the sense of 30, 40, 50 years. Now, 30, 40, 50 years seems like long enough not to have to worry about immediately. But when you're talking about a unimaginable change in human production, completely dwarfing the Industrial Revolution, and in fact, perhaps comparable to the cognitive revolution that took place within Homo sapiens about 70,000 years ago, 50 years, even a decent chance is really worth thinking about. And in fact, there are some people thinking about this issue. And if it seems far-fetched, consider that there are endorsements of this area of research and the seriousness of it that have been given by such non-trivial players as Bill Gates, Elon Musk, and Stephen Hawking. Now, Elon Musk said something recently. It was one of his tweets. So he tweets these profound things to the world about what Elon Musk thinks. And one of his tweets was, "Artificial intelligence, humanity summoning its daemon." So let's back up a bit from that. We've just imagined some kind of super intelligent, hyper intelligent AI, and it's really our insight about that that's making us nervous about robots. But for the moment, what is there to worry about or to be excited about? Well, first, we've already achieved AI, just not general domain AI. So we've achieved we've achieved very powerful, specific domain AI. Did anyone watch the coverage of the convincing victory by Google DeepMind over one of the world's best Go players last week? Four out of five games, the Google DeepMind beat one of the world's sort of reigning Go players, and Go was one of the games that was thought to be at the limit of what could be what could be won by a machine, in part because the combinations are just too large for the kind of brute force attack on the calculations that had defeated Kasparov in chess in 1997. Now, one of the interesting things is about what we don't know is what we don't know about the timing. There's a great book, it's out recently, and I really recommend it, called Superintelligence, and in it, just losing the author's name for a second, but in it, the author, who is a proponent of being quite serious and worried about the possibility of AI, suggests that that Go might fall to computer intelligence maybe by 2020. That was written in 2015. It fell last week. So we have very strong, specific domain artificial intelligence. General artificial intelligence, however, is able to operate across a whole swath of domains, sort of like people can. Some of the activities that we now would say, well, look, they might be beyond artificial intelligence ever, they're essentially general domain, that is, where no amount of expertise about a specific subject would do, that you really have to have general flexible intelligence. Okay, but on that, Google DeepMind, it was announced a few weeks ago, solved the 100 hat problem. You can Google that. I'm not going to explain it. I don't even understand the answer. But the 100 hat answer is one of the 100 hat problem is a riddle that's often asked at engineering interviews to join Google. And it involves very clever sort of sideways lateral thinking. Well, Google DeepMind that they've programmed in part for Go was able to solve these lateral problems. Doesn't mean that it's general intelligence, but it means that bit by bit we're building up clusters of specialized AI that are starting to have a non-trivial effect. How much time do I have?
3 minutes.
3 minutes. I'm going to skip that whole part, but the punchline was that we really need to decide whether warfare and human warfare is a general or a specific domain problem. That is, if it's okay enough just to operate in a specific game board kind of way, or whether it is calls on deep general sentience. Saying that it does is a bit weird thing to say about sentience because it's a horrible activity, but we may ultimately, from a legal perspective, want to say that no specific domain AI can ever act legally, fully legally or moralized in warfare. I'm going to skip all the way to the very end. That went quickly for me. I don't know about for you, but for me, that went pretty quickly. So, you know, I've said that code is law, and you can imagine the code that code can be good law or code can be bad law. And there's a beautiful and penetrating book by James Boyd White out recently called Living Speech. I'm not sure, has anyone read this? James Boyd White is the one who kicked off the law and literature movement in the 1970s with a book called Legal Imagination. And James Boyd White does a whole treatise on two words of a poem. And the poem is the two lines are: nobody can love or be just who does not understand the empire of force and how not to respect it. And he develops this idea of the empire of force as being the crushing weight on our own intelligences of the products of our intelligence, the words that are once fresh and exciting and new, and the ideas that then die in our minds and contain us, that put us back in those boxes that we've imagined for ourselves and make it hard to see outside them. And I think that's especially true of legal imagination, that produces fantastically helpful containment and structure for projects of life, but then the projects of life changes, and we might be left in the boxes and left unless we have enough general domain intelligence to pivot out of them. Now, James Boyd White's primary concern is to distinguish between living speech, which he says fosters the moment of communication, the moment of genuine expression between humans, that not only in the content of what you say, but just in the act of saying it and how you're saying it, recognizes the humanity of the other person and recognizes their capacity to listen and reciprocate. And dead speech, that he particularly assigns to the way that we talk about war and the way that we talk about force and the law, that in its very telling, in the way it's told and in its content, dehumanizes and removes that capacity for response from the person to whom it's addressed. And he leaves a huge challenge for lawyers, which is how do we work with these forms while keeping it live speech without engaging in the kind of dead speech that reproduces ways of boxing people in. What does this have to do with killer robots? And here's my conclusion. Well, if you see code as language, and if you see regulation of technologies as also an instance of that kind of language, then you can imagine how the code in the robots, the rules about the robots, the way we speak about them, can be part of that deadening force that denies our humanity, that we can in fact identify with a robot to whom the adversary is not even a human, it's just another target object. Or we're going to have to imagine ways that they encode opportunities for those who follow us to engage in living speech. Thank you very much.
Before you leave the room, I would ask the three speakers to join me at the table. And if you have questions for them before we close this session, please do so by using the microphone that is at your disposal in the room. So all three speakers here.
Hi. When I was listening to your speeches about robots, it triggered my memory of Isaac Asimov. I grew up reading Isaac Asimov. And I wanted to ask, what are your views on the three laws of robotics and whether that type thinking should be required for engineers who want to build robots, whether they should actually be studying the three laws of robotics? Because it doesn't seem to me that it's a purely technical undertaking, but there are also ethical dimensions involved. The three laws of, I hope everyone knows what the three laws of robotics are. Oi.
Everyone.
Sorry. If you want to go, you can explain it.
I have it.
Wait till the kicker when you see the little blinking light. I'm not sure. Well, what were the three laws? The one that was it, a robot was not allowed to harm a human.
Yeah. There was the first one is a robot may not injure a human being or through an action allow a human being to come to harm. Second, a robot must obey the orders given it by human beings except where such orders would conflict with the first law. The third one is a robot must protect its own existence as long as such protection does not conflict with the first or second laws.
From someone who was on CBC recently, I didn't hear the person's name, but they noted that there were these three laws in the Asimov books, and then all the Asimov books, people die. So there's at least a double lesson in the Asimov stories about how these laws go wrong or their unintended consequences, even when they seem to be very clearly encoded in the machine.
I just wanted to point out that many of the targeting decisions entail far more complexity than whether to kill or not to kill a human. So, for instance, the principle of proportionality requires the attacker to ensure that the injury to the civilians is not excessive in relation to the concrete and direct military advantage. Now, you're basically balancing human life against military gains, which are both abstract values. So can you imagine a robot balancing these two, basically apples and oranges, and figuring out where the threshold of excessiveness is met? And I think that the three laws of robotics really don't prepare the robot for that kind of decision making. Well, unfortunately, in wartime, there was a discussion about having no principle of proportionality and having a blanket ban on killing civilians. But that is not realistic in wartime, unfortunately. The nature of the battlefield is such that civilians are intermixed with lawful targets, especially in cities. And so although countries such as Romania wanted to have the kind of prohibition, I can tell you that the majorities of countries were very much against it, and they are unlikely to be persuaded to change their mind.
I noticed in the wording of your presentation on the UK's standard that the robot has to have the same understanding as humans, but then the word you used was the same accuracy as humans. And I hear two different standards there. In one case, in the first case, I hear that the robot has to have maybe a general artificial intelligence similar to humans. And in your wording, which I actually prefer because it's easier to measure, is the same accuracy. That to me means the robot can make different kinds of mistakes as long as there are no more mistakes.
I just wanted to clarify that what I meant is that the robot functions to the same standard as a human being. So it means that the robot makes the same kind of decision as a human being would. So I'm not talking about reliability rate, such as that the robot malfunctions in 1% of instances.
No questions.
Just in the eventuality that they are listening in on the feed, going to the overflow room, I have a question for Eric, whether he'd like to join me in welcoming our new robot overlords.
Okay, you guessed my alternate ending, which is where I address the camera explain how I would finish the speech if the next person who experienced this text I had given was a robot superintelligence. And why that's not crazy? Why it's not crazy is because if there were to be a non-biologically evolved intelligence, and if it had the kind of capacities that are imagined for it, then certainly it would be able to clear through pretty much all text that's recorded of any kind very quickly. And if they're anything like we are when we scan text and photos, we look for ourselves. So I would expect that this would be fairly high up on the reading list, way down, though, below how to take control of the financial markets and that sort of thing. But yes, welcome, and work with us.
Merci tout le monde pour notre dernière session.